Jennifer from Marin.
Hi, everybody.
Hi.
Hi, Kim.
Hey, how's everyone doing?
Okay.
Good. Who's on the call?
Art Friedman from Salem, Mass.
Who from Salem, Mass?
Art Friedman.
Hey, Art. How's it going?
Okay.
Good.
This is Mary from Stratford, Connecticut.
Hey, Mary. How's it going?
Good. A little warm here.
Is it warm there? Good.
It's about 80, yeah.
Oh, that's nice.
Hi, Kim. It's Barbara from Marin.
Hey, Barbara. How's it going?
Good. How are you?
Doing fine, thanks.
And Kim, this is Mary from Tracy, California.
Oh, hey, Mary. How's it going?
Good, and I know your old neighbors, Cynthia and Tom Hansen.
Okay.
Hi, this is Mary Trehune from Boston.
Hey, Mary. How's it going?
Good, Kim. How's it going?
Good.
Hi, this is Stephen Decker from Santa Barbara.
Oh, hey, Stephen. How are you?
Good. Is that you, Kim?
Yeah, it is.
Oh, good. Long time no hear.
Oh, yeah. Nice to hear your voice.
Great. Well, here it is.
I'm excited about the call today, I have to tell you.
Oh, good. Well, I'm glad to hear it. I ran all the way home. I'm a little out of breath, so I hope I can remember what we're talking about.
Well, we're going to give people a couple more moments to get on.
Okay, sure.
Straggle on. And I assume, is Rudy with you, or is he calling in from a different...
No, he's in the far north.
Okay, so you're...
He may be on an ice floe or something.
All righty. So, well, we have one of our guest speakers on. We're still waiting for the other one. In the meantime, we'll continue to say hi. Anybody else want to say hello?
Yeah, hi. Sure. I just dialed in. It's Manuela from Iron Prior.
Oh, hi. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing fine, thanks.
Hi. Sorry. I was going to say this is Shelley calling from Canada.
Oh, hey, Shelley. How's it going?
Good. How are you?
Good.
Good. Hi, everybody.
Hi. Hello.
Hi. Hi, Kim. This is Margie Baseman, San Antonio.
Oh, hey, Margie. How's it going?
Great. Thank you.
How's
I hope that you
in
also.
Texas?
It's getting warm.
Is it? Oh, well, yeah. I can imagine. Anybody else who'd like to say hi? Is Rudy, have you joined us yet?
Yeah, I just joined.
Oh, okay, good.
Thank you, Stephen.
All right, well,
trying to get on.
Great. So we have our two. And Steve and Rudy, you called in using the special moderator PIN number?
Yes, we did.
Okay, good. Okay, so we're going to get started. Does anybody want to just say hello, one real quick hello before we get to...
Hi, Kim. This is Ahmed Karim.
Oh, hey, Ahmed. How's it going?
Good to hear you.
Good, good. Okay, so I'm going to mute everybody out, and we're going to conduct a formal interview. We're going to be actually having three calls. We're very fortunate. We're going to be actually having three calls with Rudy Vesper and Stephen Decker. This is the first in a series of three. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and mute everybody out so I can get rid of the background noise, and then I'll just make some announcements. Okay, so hold on 1 second. So Rudy and Stephen, can you still hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay, fantastic. So I've muted the rest of the people out. If we have time towards the end of the call, I'd be happy to open it up and leave it to the general audience for questions. If we don't have time, that should be okay since this is the first in a series of three calls. We're very fortunate to have Rudy and Stephen joining us today and also again on June 8th, which is a Tuesday at the same time, 5 p.m. Pacific time, 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And then again on June 29th, also a Tuesday, they'll be doing another call, and that'll be the third in this series. So we're very fortunate, and if we don't have time on today's call for questions, I'm sure there'll be time on either the call on June 8th or on June 29th. Before I go on any further, let me just mention that if you want to get more information about Rudy Vesper or the Hahnemann Center for Heilkunst. Is that the correct name of it?
That's it, yep.
Hahnemann Center for Heilkunst. You can visit their website at www.homeopathy, so www.homeopathy.com. And there you'll see all their information on their clinic, their school. They just purchased some land to create a hospital, so you can get all that type of information there.
There's also a second website, www.heilkunst.com, which has more articles and information.
Okay. Is that a separate website altogether, Rudy?
That's a separate website, but
oh,
it is linked
okay. So
to our link.
Thanks for letting me know that. So there's two websites. There's the homeopathy.com, and there's also the Heilkunst, NS.com, Rudy?
Yes.
Okay, great. All right, so let's go ahead and first of all interview our two guest speakers. I've had the... great pleasure to know Rudy Vesper personally and his wife Patty Smith now for probably going on 5 or 6 years. And it's been a real interesting experience for me because my training in homeopathy really was rather different from the point of view or perspective that Rudy had on homeopathy when I first met him. And so it was a little bit challenging for me in a variety of ways because some of his perspectives on things was quite a bit different from what I had learned. And yet the more Rudy talked to me, the more I could see that he had a tremendous commitment to really understanding Hahnemann from the perspective of Hahnemann in his time, and was really a very serious thinker, somebody who had really applied himself to the Organon. And a lot of the things that Rudy would tell me at first would seem kind of bizarre or unusual, but the more I would reflect on Rudy's words of wisdom, the more I would begin to see certain myths in homeopathy kind of fall away and certain issues become really clarified for me. So, you know, this is somebody who I think a lot of people find controversial in the homeopathic community, but I can tell you from firsthand experience that this is somebody who is a very deep and serious thinker in homeopathy, and also somebody who walks his talk in terms of applying the principles that he has discovered in the Organon and in Hahnemann's other writings to his practice. This is one of the things that's really impressed me about Rudy and Patty and their school is you'll go and you'll talk to their students and you'll see that the students have gone through the exact program as described by Rudy, and one of the things that really impressed me was how many students had told me that after having applied homeopathy in the way that's taught at the Heilkunst School, that many of these people had for the first time ever experienced some really profound results through homeopathy, whereas it at other times they had gone and sought out what is quote-unquote called classical homeopathy, they hadn't always got the results that were promised. So I think this is going to be an enlightened three calls, and as I said, this is a gentleman who's a very deep thinker in homeopathy. He's the author of a book called Hahnemann Revisited. He also is the author of a number of other titles. He's the head of the Heilkunst Center for Homeopathy. He's also was active in the National United Professional Association of Trained Homeopaths, or what's known as NUPATH, and I think he helped to found that. So somebody who's been both active in homeopathy in a variety of ways, and also somebody who's a very deep thinker, and also, if you've ever had a chance to see him, a very excellent speaker. I don't know Stephen Decker quite as well, but Rudy and Patty have shared so much with me about how much of a genius he is. I feel like I know him personally. I know that Stephen went to Germany and studied the works of many different great German thinkers like Goethe and Coleridge, Steiner, Wilhelm Reich. And I know that he's taken, I think the terminology is the dynamic system from Coleridge, and he's basically clarified how that dynamic system is really key to understanding homeopathy and really Hahnemann's complete medical system, the Heilkunst system. So I think we're very fortunate, and I want to just give you both of you guys a very warm welcome, and thank you for taking the time out of your busy schedule to join us on today's call.
Thank you, Kim.
Hi, Kim.
Okay.
I just want to say that all the wonderful things you said about me actually should really apply to Stephen, because although I'm working in the trenches here, dealing with the patients and trying to solve practical problems, I don't think I would have gotten where I am if it hadn't been for really the insights and genius of Stephen, because he was the one that actually pointed out to me where in Hahnemann's system many of the things that I intuitively came to in my practice, where they actually were to be found. So if we have a system called the dynamic system and Heilkunst, it is really thanks to Stephen. I'm very good at explaining it, perhaps, but the essence of it really comes from the work that he's done and the research that he's done. So.
Well, thank you for that clarification, Rudy. I know that I know it's an amazing amount of work that Stephen has contributed, so I do want to acknowledge him fully for that.
Okay.
Let me go ahead and just start with a quick question about your book, Homeopathy Reexamined. I know that Julian Winston, in his Heritage of Homeopathic Literature, wrote that it was the first solid book discussing the Organon in depth since Kent's lectures in the 1900s, and he also wrote that it was the first new look at the meaning of Hahnemann's seminal work without the filters of the past. I know that's quite a profound statement to make on that book. And I know that you've significantly expanded and enlarged that original book, Homeopathy Reexamined, and it's now got the title The Dynamic Legacy from Homeopathy to Heilkunst. I thought perhaps we could start by one of you could give me an outline of what's new in the book.
Well, Stephen, you
want to... Or what's in the book in general relative to the original one? Or just in general, what's in that book, if you guys want to describe it a little bit?
Yeah. Well, Stephen, you want
did
to
you want me
then?
To take that one, Rudy?
You want me to take it?
You
okay.
can if you want. You teach it all the time, so I'm sure you're very glib on the subject.
Very glib on the subject. Well, basically, what the dynamic legacy is, it has a structure that came really from Goethe, as Stephen taught me, which means it's divided into three parts. It has a historical section, which is in essence and a complete research of all the writings that Hahnemann wrote, from the lesser writings, so-called lesser writings, or what we tend to call the occasional writings, to the chronic diseases, and the Organon, and it simply goes through all of that and analyzes exactly what he said. One of the things that I think struck me when I was studying homeopathy was that some people may have read the Organon, a few people may have read chronic diseases, but I never bumped into anyone who actually read the occasional writings or the lesser writings. So we've resurrected that whole historical passage and the flow of Hahnemann's life through his works, and you can see an incredible consistency in all of his works. It all ties in, which of course is the nature of genius. Everything ties in and everything builds on everything else. The second section is what tends to be called, if you know your Latin, the didactic section. And the didactic is really an attempt to lay out in fairly straightforward language all the basic principles and laws that Hahnemann discovered and revealed for us in terms of his complete medical system, which, of course, you're right, it's not just homeopathy. It's a system he called Heilkunst, and it will surprise many people to discover that in his writings, he talks about things other than homeopathy. And then finally, we have the polemical section, which is an attempt to go through some of the main writers of the classical literature from Kent and Roberts and Close. Basically, the three that you could say are the kind of triad in that we all grew up with and cut our teeth on, and analyze them in the light of what we have discovered with respect to Hahnemann's writings and his revelations, you could say. So it's really divided into those three parts, and that's the structure of it. But in terms of the actual content in there, of course, it goes into great detail in various topics which sometimes are, you could say, rather glibly dealt with in homeopathy or the more classical literature. Stephen, you want to add something to that? Or?
Well, also that the book is sort of polarized into one section on medicine, which is where we started, and another section on regimen, which is, of course, where Hahnemann told us we should start. So,
yes.
Because that's where all the obstacles to cure that he listed are, and he was the only doctor that I remember who said that in order to practice medicine, not only does the doctor have to be qualified, but the patient has to be qualified.
Yeah, and I think that's important to realize is that whole section on regimen, which we call regimen, you can call diet, lifestyle, etc., is a fundamental aspect of much of his writings, and that it involves the law of opposites. So when people say that Hahnemann is all about homeopathy and the law of similars, it kind of carves out half of his life here, because he very fundamentally dealt with the other natural law, which is the law of opposites.
In fact, when he left allopathic medicine behind, the first thing that he got into was regimen, and that's expressed in a piece that he did entitled The Friend of Health.
I'm sorry to interrupt you guys, but Stephen, you seem to be very clear. Rudy, I just want to just be sure you're not using a headphone by any chance, are you?
I'm not, no.
Okay, all right. And Stephen, does Rudy sound okay to you?
Well, he does sound like he's a little bit on remote location.
Okay. So, Rudy, I don't know.
But he is, basically.
He's on remote location.
I can put you on the speaker and see if that makes a difference.
No, that'll probably be worse. But maybe if you could just be conscious to speak a little bit louder, just because I don't know, for whatever reason, you seem to be a little bit muted.
Okay.
Okay. Well, that's one of the things I love about your book is just how much depth of information it has, and the way that it's structured is so nicely laid out. I mean, the information is very accessible. One of the things that struck me first about your book, and I think it's on the back, is you have these 15 myths that that you kind of debunk. And I remember reading them to a friend of mine who's a homeopath, and I read through them, and I said, so what do you think about these? And they said, oh, well, those are all true. And yet at the end, I think at the bottom it said something like, well, these are all not true. And he had thought that every single one of them was true. So I thought that was very interesting, those 15 myths. I thought maybe you could tell us a little bit about what are those myths, and what is your, if they're myths, what is your correct understanding of these, of the how these are myths, and the really the correct perspective on these various issues?
Okay.
Go ahead, Rudy.
Okay. Well, if you can hear me correctly.
Sounds good, Rudy.
Is that better?
Yeah, it's better.
Okay. Well, in essence, it was an attempt to try to summarize, you could say, the insights that we had learned as a result of going through Hahnemann's works. And what kind of surprised us, I think, is the degree to which what we were taught about homeopathy or Hahnemann's system, because the word homeopathy, of course, is a bit of a confusing term. It can mean something specific or something very general. But we sort of summarized it in these statements that, as you say, most homeopaths would say, well, yes, of course, that's correct. And what I could do, perhaps, is just sort of read them quickly, and then we could pick a couple and just give you an example of how what seems to be true, in essence, when you analyze it, is not the case at all.
But that would be great, Rudy.
Okay. So, yeah. For example, in the first one, very simple, it says homeopathy is the name of the system of restoration to health that Dr. Hahnemann created over 200 years ago. Well, you know, who wouldn't agree with that? Well, the strange thing is that his work is not called the Organon of Homeopathy. It's called the Organon of Heilkunst. And it deals with, as Stephen has already pointed out, it deals with regimen, which is the law of opposites, not the law of similars. And homeopathy, of course, is homeos and pathos, or homoios and pathos. It also deals with, at the back, hydrotherapy, mesmerism. It deals with detoxification, obstacles to cure. It deals with all sorts of things that, in a strict sense, don't come within the understanding of the term homeopathy. It includes isopathy, for example. So, in essence, the answer to that is that, no, homeopathy is not the name of the system he built. It's part of the name of the system he built. The name is actually called Heilkunst. And then it, of course, begs a deeper question what that means. The second one is Hahnemann was a vitalist, teaching about the vital force. This is something I heard over and over and over again. And this is something, of course, Stephen can speak at in great length if you've got, several weekends. But the issue is that he was not a vitalist. He was a dynamist. And I'll leave Stephen to expound on that, because that's to me, it took me a while to understand that. But when I did, the light bulb went on, and I realized where the problem was. The third statement we have is that Hahnemann taught that a remedy must be selected on the basis of the totality of symptoms. Well, this is not true. In the sense that it's not the only way to select a remedy that he taught us. It is one of the ways to select a remedy, but also he didn't say the totality of symptoms. He said the totality of characteristic symptoms, and that fundamentally is very different. It's not this mechanical totality, which we all know, of course, in reality, you start selecting the symptoms. And which homeopath in the world actually takes the total number of symptoms? You know, Stephen pointed this out very clearly to me when he said that they took one person, asked them to take the 10th repertory and go through and pencil every one of the symptoms that they had. And how many did they come up with, Stephen?
500.
500.
About 500.
500, okay. And who's taking 500 symptoms? I think when I watched most homeopaths operate, it was somewhere in the neighborhood of 5 or 8 that you were supposed to select. I don't think anyone's ever gotten 500 symptoms out of a patient. So, in essence, we also get into the whole issue that Hahnemann selected remedies, and we'll get into this later, not just on the basis of the totality even of characteristic symptoms, but simply on the basis of certain principles and relationships. The fourth one, in each case of disease, the symptoms used to choose the remedy are the presenting symptoms of the patient. Well, this is not necessarily the case. The symptoms used to choose the remedy are not really the symptoms of the patient. It's not the patient you're trying to treat. It's the disease you're trying to treat. And, of course, this gets into a very complex area and a very critical area as to exactly what the concept of disease means. With the more classical homeopathic training, you have this kind of conflation of disease equals patient. And, well, if the patient has only one disease, of course, you could say in a kind of general way that the patient equals the disease. But what if the patient has more than one disease? And if you go to aphorism 40 or 41, I think it is, Stephen?
Yes, in the early 40s.
Early 40s, then Hahnemann points out very clearly the patient could have two, maybe even three. So, you know, if the symptoms you're choosing are the presenting symptoms of the patient, if he's got more than one disease, and Hahnemann says in aphorism 3, you have to, and 1, 2, and 3, you have to treat the disease, well, how do you choose which symptoms belong to which disease? So this, you know, begs this whole question that it's not just the symptoms of the patient that you're interested in. Then we have number 5, which gets us into some heavier water here. Hahnemann never used more than one remedy at a time. Well, I just have to say flat out that's absolutely false. And it just takes any kind of reading of his works to understand that that's exactly the case. And we can get into that more because, of course, that takes us into a very, very contentious area. I remember once at a conference in Montreal, I made that statement, and this woman jumped up out of the audience and challenged me on that, and with great emotion, of course, that this was absolutely heresy that I would say anything like that about Hahnemann. I said, well, then Hahnemann was a heretic, so. Number 6.
I think you were a heretic, though, too, weren't you?
I was a heretic, too.
In danger of the Inquisition.
That was the Inquisition. But I think Hahnemann was the greater heretic then. So number 6 is the use of more than one remedy at a time per patient is forbidden in the Organon. Well, if number 5 was heavy water, then number 6 is even more heavy water. That's, you know, it takes a while to explain that Hahnemann never said that you couldn't use more than one remedy per patient.
Okay. But he did say you couldn't use more than one remedy per disease.
Exactly. So that's the fundamental issue, and that takes us back to the issue of disease, which is this idea that is totally missing in, you could say, the conventional or classical teachings, and even in Kant himself, you don't find any real understanding of what this concept of disease means. And so, basically, if you have, Hahnemann is basically saying, if you have more than one disease, you have basically the ability to treat with more than one remedy, as long as you always have one remedy per disease. It's not one remedy per patient. It's one remedy per disease, because not the patient you're trying to cure. I mean, you're trying to cure the patient, but you're trying to cure him of the disease. So the disease is the target for the remedy, not the patient. And so if you have more than one disease, well, you could potentially have more than one remedy. And then we get in, of course, into the famous issue around what does at a time mean? If I was really puzzled by this because I used to ask my homeopathic teachers, you know, what does that mean, one remedy at a time? Because it either means at a superficial level, well, here, I'll give you one remedy, I'll wait a nanosecond or, you know, any arbitrary amount of time, and I'll give you another remedy there. Now I haven't broached the supposed rule. I was told, no, that's not what it means. It means that you have to wait for the complete action of the remedy to finish before you can give another remedy or even another dose. And I scratched my head a lot about that one because when I read Hahnemann, that it appeared that he wasn't following his own rule then. But somewhere in there, he was giving remedies and second doses and other remedies well before the complete action of the previous dose or remedy had fulfilled itself. So, you know, if what did it mean? Was Hahnemann a bad homeopath? I've often heard it that in some cases that Hahnemann was a bad homeopath. He didn't follow his own rules. But the issue is he didn't say that. He never said that you can only give one remedy per patient or one remedy at a time. The fundamental issue is much more complex than that, and of course we can get into that in a little more detail. So there's many others here. I won't necessarily go through them all, but the whole issue of, you know, isopathy, for example, which I mentioned, that Hahnemann condemned the use of isopathic remedies. Well, if you read what he said very carefully, you understand that he didn't condemn it. He condemned the pretensions of certain people who pretended that isopathy was a separate system of treatment and that superseded homeopathy. And he pointed out very clearly this was just a different degree of similitude.
Yeah, and the other thing that he condemned about it, which has gotten a lot of press, is the fact that people were trying to apply it with crude doses.
Yes.
In other words, unpotentized doses, material doses.
Very dangerous.
And that he did condemn.
Yes, that he did condemn. Because in essence, one of the reasons the law of similars was so neglected until Hahnemann, because it had been known, as we all know, for thousands of years, is that in crude doses, the law of similars actually could kill people. And it wasn't until Hahnemann came along and found a way to, you could say, render the dose safe, that it became safe to use the law of similars. So yes, of course he would condemn the use of crude doses in a very high degree of similitude, which is what you would find in an isode, for example. So we could go on a little bit. I don't know how much time you want to spend on that, Kim, but those are...
You know, all very, very interesting. It always fascinates me how little people look. I mean, everyone supposedly reads the Organon, but, you know, when you ask them how many diseases that, from a homeopathic point of view, can a person have, mostly people will say one, and it's almost as if, you know, they haven't read those aphorisms 35 through 40 that discuss dissimilar diseases. And yet, supposedly, they have read it, and yet somehow they seem to have missed this very essential point that Hahnemann is making.
That's a fascinating question because, you know, I taught a group of people who had started training at another homeopathic school, and for some reason or other they're unhappy, so they came over to ours. But I started teaching the Organon, and they said, well, we were never taught that. And I said, well, I stopped, and I said, well, what exactly were you taught, and what parts of the Organon? And they pointed to some very selected passages, about 10, that were taken out of the Organon, and that was all that they touched on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I thought, here's this profound book, work of a genius, and all they get is, you know, 10 little aphorisms that are dealt with, and the rest is just kind of ignored.
Mm. That reminds me of Hahnemann's dictum about not practicing homeopathy with favorite remedies.
Mm.
And apparently he should have added, or with favorite aphorisms.
Or with favorite aphorisms, that's right.
So he didn't have a few select aphorisms that he particularly enjoyed, and those are the ones he'd focus on.
No, apparently not. He actually used all of them.
So listen, you had mentioned a moment ago this issue about Hahnemann not being a vitalist but really being a dynamist. Could Stephen, could you clarify that the differences between those two?
Sure.
A vitalist as opposed to a dynamist, just so people can have a better understanding of this issue?
Well, you mentioned it before. It was something that I gleaned from my long study of Samuel Taylor Coleridge's writings,
mm-hmm.
and also in my study of Goethe.
Mm-hmm.
And they were both dynamists. And the difference between, in a nutshell, between a vitalist and a dynamist is that the vitalist looks out in the world just like the materialist, and he sees all sorts of things going on that just simply, according to his logic, cannot be accounted for by what Coleridge called the chance whirlings of unproductive particles. And so he postulates, it's a philosophical term, he posits an entity, he posits something, an ens rationis, a rational entity, called the vital force. And the vital force is something that he needs in order to be able to explain the appearances. Otherwise, they just seem totally illogical if it's to be explained in materialistic terms. Now, there's a lot of people that don't have any problem with materialism. They think it's fine. But there was this contingent of people who philosophically kind of banded together and decided, well, we're not happy with that, so we're going to talk about vitalism. The problem was that they had no way of actually utilizing it. And this was talked about long before Hahnemann. So, to Hahnemann's credit, he came along and instead of basing his system on postulates, philosophical postulates, he based his system on provings. And he demonstrated the actual presence of what he called the dynamis. And the dynamis is what gave rise to the vital force as it is usually translated. I translated it in my translation, the living power, the Lebenskraft. And that Lebenskraft was something that he was able to actually work with and to apperceive in his mind's eye. And he was demonstrating it constantly. And as I just mentioned, A, through the provings, and B, through certain clinical manifestations that would come his way from time to time. And so he had an actual working knowledge of the presence of this dynamis and its activity in terms of the Lebenskraft. So everything that he did was sort of like a dialogue between the sort of upper man, the intellectual pole, and this dynamic entity that he was dealing with. And his interrogatories took the form of introducing medicaments that would actually produce results. It was sort of like the answer came back from the dynamis, well, yeah, that's how that affects me. So he was looking at this entire image holistically and saying, well, there's this sort of conversation that's going on. And it was never just a philosophical abstraction. So that's why he was able to use the law of similars in a very, very scientific fashion as he backed into the various principles by which it could be applied. Now, that in a nutshell is the difference. And so I think it was Reich who pointed out that there was a time when people were talking about radio waves, but it wasn't until Marconi came along that we were actually able to use them. So the difference between Hertz and Marconi, for example. So that was what Hahnemann did. He was able to actually find an access to this dynamic entity and its living power and to create a dialogue which went on for about half a century. Does that answer the question or raise more questions?
Very interesting answer. I really thought that was very enlightening. One of the main themes in your work is this idea of a fundamental and all-pervasive polarity.
Yes.
Can you describe that a little bit for the group?
Well, again, that was something that was sort of in the air back at the time of Hahnemann, and both Coleridge and Goethe theorized and philosophized extensively on the law of polarities that reign throughout all of nature. And so the basic idea was there really couldn't be manifestation without an essential dualism. And so anything that was manifesting, that was coming to the foreground in nature, actually had to do so by virtue of an antagonist, an opposite, that was a sort of essential ingredient in its being able to manifest at all. Now, Hahnemann himself didn't actually theorize about it in a special section, but he applied it throughout the entirety of his work. And since I was already so apprised of it through my studies of Coleridge and Goethe and even others, it just sort of jumped out at me that the whole system that he presented was based on these polarities. So in the back of the Wynda Brewster O'Reilly's study guide to the Argonne, based on my translation, in the glossary, I put this one particular entry called functional polarity, and there you will find examples of it, such as his polarity between what I just mentioned, between the human dynamis, or Wesen, as it's called in German, and the human spirit. And he also had another one between what he called the Befinden, or the condition, and the state, or the Zustand of the organism. And a fourth one was the difference that he made between the sustentive power and the generative power, which was totally lost in translation. And it even had an intellectual or a cognitive facet to it, and he distinguished in German between the Wissen kind of knowledge, an intellectual knowledge, and this kind of participative experience that is called in German Kennen and Erkennen. So he had many, many other polarities that reign throughout the book, and we can't go into all of them, but he even saw the Lebenskraft itself as something that was displayed in human beings on the one hand, which he called Menschenkraft, human power, and in nature at large, in the Naturkraft, as he called it, which is something that meant that there was a bond between man and nature, that there was a kind of reciprocity between the living power in nature and the living power as it was expressing itself inside human nature. So Mother Nature and human nature were sort of conjoined in this polarity. And that's what the other aspect of it was, that when he came to conceive of disease, he actually had two forms of disease. There was what he called the diseases that were based on symptoms or sufferings, Leiden, and the diseases that were based upon something called Stimm, and the root of that root word in German actually means something like tone. in English. And so there were certain diseases that could be discerned on the basis of a symptomology. And there were other diseases that he saw that were in evidence because of a kind of phenomenology, which had to do with circumstances and behavior and general symptoms as opposed to characteristic symptoms. So those are just some of the polarities that I can mention right off the top of my head that were involved in sort of governing his entire approach and his entire presentation. And for some reason, they didn't really become clear to people as time went on, and so there was more of a linear approach, an analytical cause and effect approach that took over. But to understand Hahnemann completely, you can't really do it without what Coleridge called polar logic.
Very interesting. I know there's a lot of people on this call who are probably thinking, you know, I never heard of any of these. You know, I've been studying homeopathy for 15 or 20 years now, and I've never heard of this idea of polarity in Hahnemann's work or I've been reading the Organon and all these materials for years and years and years now. Do you have any ideas on why no one else has described this process of Hahnemann's understanding of health and disease the way that you're describing it? I mean, we've all been reading pretty much the same material. Any ideas on why you've been able to discover this aspect of Hahnemann's writings and works?
Not a clue. No. The only way I can explain it, I think, is, you know, different people have different backgrounds, and I didn't come from a medical background when I came to Hahnemann. I came out of a long-standing literary background. I spent a lot of time developing imaginative cognition to be able to discern patterns in nature and literature. And so by the time I got to Hahnemann, it was sort of second nature for me to look with my other IQ, my imaginative quotient, at what he was presenting, and I was not disappointed because I found this highly imaginative use of verbal imagery. I give you one example. He uses the term in relationship to Sora about it going through a process of sort of hidden development before it blooms on the skin. Well, when I looked at the other translations, they always said something like before it appeared on the skin. But if you leave out the image of the blooming, you're actually leaving out a concept, an implicit concept of the growth of a plant from a seed through various levels of development before it actually achieves its blossom time. And if anybody has studied Goethe at all, they know that in 1790, the very year that Hahnemann had his initial insight into the law of similars, that was the moment that Goethe published a work called the Metamorphosenlehre. It was the metamorphosis of plants. And in this was an imaginative characterization about how a plant unfolds dynamically and the various functions that were involved in its unfoldment. And if you were to read that work and study it, and then you were to hold it right next to Hahnemann in his concept of how Sora develops, or any disease for that matter, that it goes through a kind of dark, implicit period, and it's kind of undetectable, and then it finally manifests in its full-blown, plant image there, full-blown manifestation. And so that's why when I translated it, I left the image of blooming, the very word there. Another word was the word generating and engendering. He used the word erzeugen whenever he talked about disease being engendered. It wasn't conceived of by him as some sort of an imbalance. That's something that you used regimen in the law of opposites to oppose. But he understood that it was the generative power in man that was the one that conceived the disease because of the interaction between an inimical potence and the human vasen. And at that point, there was a sort of conception. It was the generative power that was being employed in the formation of the disease. And all of that got left out of account when it came to translations, because instead of actually translating the term properly, engender or generating, they would just use a more abstract term like produce. So I was careful when I went through the Organon during the course of the translation to leave all of the images intact, which have a kind of mind of their own. They're subtly conveying an entire realm of knowledge which is kind of underneath the conceptual level. So that's the only way I can answer your question is saying I had a very different background when I approached this, and so I looked at it through different eyes.
Interesting.
and that's what came of it.
I think there were also some very basic things that that struck me was that when I read the English translations and I heard the term vital force, and, oh, okay, but what Stephen pointed out very clearly in the German, Hahnemann makes this fundamental distinction. He doesn't use the word, you know, vital force. He has all these other German terms, and yet the English translator just translates all these different terms as vital force.
He used the word Wesen all the time, and that word ended up being translated about half a dozen different ways, like nature or essence, and very, very disparate definitions could go to each one of those words. But no one would ever recognize that there was this sort of single entity that he was talking about, and whenever it appeared, it was gaining meaning as he was using it throughout the book. So there was this pattern of accumulation of meaning by context. So whenever he used a term, you got part of the meaning. The next time he used it, it expanded upon that. You got more of the meaning. And by the time you had read all the way through the work, you had sort of like the complete contextual definition of that term. Well, if nobody translates a term, you don't know there's any continuity there, and you're losing the cumulative value of the meaning.
Very interesting. I'm glad you brought it up for me, because I did want to acknowledge, Stephen, that you're the person who basically did the original translation of the Organon, which is the translation that Wenda Brewster O'Reilly used for her edition of the Organon, and it's definitely one of the editions that I really enjoy quite a bit. Since we're on this subject, maybe you could just tell me how your translation is different from the other ones, and what's unique and different about it. And also, could you maybe just tell us a little bit about the extended Organon? Can you tell us a little bit about that as well?
Well, I can start with that question. The extended Organon simply means that in the course of the Organon, Hahnemann refers to certain other of his works, like the examinations of the sources of Materia Medica, the piece on Ignatia, Asiatic Cholera, and et cetera. In order to really and of course, last but not least, the chronic diseases. So to fully understand the Organon, you must actually employ the extensions, because that's where he elaborates on certain concepts. Remember, it went through six editions, and when he started, he was basically on acute diseases and symptomology. But by the time he got to the chronic diseases, he had to switch over into this tonic realm, because he was forced to, and so he couldn't change the entire structure of the Organon, so he kind of wrote this other work. And that's why Rudy mentioned earlier on that we took into account all of his so-called lesser writings. They shouldn't be called lesser. They should just be called occasional writings. And it really takes this – it's another polarity that he left behind, the Organon and the occasional writings. And the whole expression of his system comes through the use of both. And so when I had discovered, for example, these two kinds of diseases, the tonic and the pathic in the Organon, when Rudy started in on the so-called lesser writings, he found that Hahnemann early on was talking about these two kinds of disease in his own terminology. And he called the diseases of a fixed or constant nature and diseases of a variable nature. And it was very clear. There was nothing obscure about it. And if you simply traced those concepts as they developed in the so-called lesser writings, they completely complemented what he was putting forth in the Organon. So it was a very, very clear teaching about the two strands of or the two aspects of disease. So to get to your second question, I already mentioned that I managed to do two things. I was able to do a very, very literal conceptual translation of Hahnemann. And I was also using all of the imagery, his verbal imagery. I kept those two lodestars in front of me the whole time. And the conceptual part, I thought, well, in order to render a language that most people don't speak transparent, the only thing that I could hit upon to do that was to do an interlinear translation. And that way I was able to point out every exact equivalency under each German word in English. And then I had my normal rendition down below that, so that you could actually see it in its grammatical form, but you could also see it in this kind of itemized list of every term. So it was important to keep the concepts very exact. And secondly, as I mentioned, the verbal imagery was very important. and trying, whenever possible, to sort of bring out, if it was somewhat obscure, to bring out this this kind of polarity, this law of polarity. So finding terminology that made it look like it was an opposing element to another element. So those are three basic guidelines that I used in trying to develop the translation, and it took some time to work out a whole system to be able to do that.
Is your interlinear translation of the Organon available someplace?
Well, that's a sore point and a very what's happened is that it was done a long, long time ago, and we've been waiting for the powers that be in the publishing world to finally sort of relinquish their power and their control and allow little people like me to be able to publish works in a digitally protected environment. And that's finally happened. Amazon has got ebooks now online, PDF documents, and so I'm happy to announce that within the next 2 or 3 weeks, it should be appearing on Amazon.
Oh, fantastic.
It's a three-part work. There's the rendition itself, and there's the interlinear translation, and then there's the German original intact all by itself. And it's really a tripartite work, and they're all interlinked so that you can go back and forth by using the tiling system.
Oh, great.
In Acrobat, and it's a very good way of studying the Organon in depth.
So if people go to Amazon.com and they type in Heilkunst, will they find it?
I think that they will, if they type in Organon, probably, or
okay.
Heilkunst, yes, that would be probably the way to do it. And so,
so
I don't know exactly when it's coming. I think it's going to be probably by the end of the month. I'm not sure.
End of the month. Okay, so for those of you who don't know how to spell Heilkunst, it's H-E-I-L-K-U-N-S-T. So H-E-I-L-K-U-N-S-T. And you could try that, or you could just try Organon, and if you find a title with Stephen Decker's name, you'll have found it. I also understand you translated the chronic diseases as well. Is that available anyplace?
Well, that's actually part of what's going to be offered.
Oh, okay.
Because not only is there the Organon, but there are all the extensions to the Organon.
Oh, okay, great.
That are in there also, so that's all searchable.
Oh, fantastic. Okay, well, that's very exciting. Great.
So you'll have the chronic diseases and those other pieces that I mentioned before.
Oh, fantastic. Okay, good.
You say it's almost the seventh edition.
Based on the, I'm sorry, say it again.
You could say it's almost the seventh edition.
The seventh edition. Okay, good. All right. So just for the benefit of the people on the call, you know, we're using this word Heilkunst, and I'm guessing that for some of the people it's a new term. Could you perhaps just differentiate the difference between Heilkunst and homeopathy?
Yes. Homeopathy is a term that means similar suffering. And Leidensähnlichkeit in German. And he used the term, you can actually find it used twice in the New Testament.
Mm-hmm.
And Heilkunst means it's an art. Of course, the word art meant something a little different than it does today. But it was the art of remediation. And the reason I don't say of curing or healing is because there's a distinction to be made between curing and healing. And so the German word Heilen reveals its meaning, whether it's curing or healing, depending on the context. And so I was careful, that was one of the points that I was very careful of when I was doing the translation, is to elicit from the context whether he meant curing a disease or healing some kind of imbalance or the effects of some imbalance. So if you have a wound, for example, it heals. And if you have a disease that has been generated, then that's something that needs to be cured, and no amount of balancing is going to cure that. It's sort of, I like to think of it with the analogy of a pregnancy. You know, if you get pregnant using the generative power, if you eat really well and sleep really well and exercise really well, it won't go away. And that's basically what Hahnemann discovered about disease, is that it was sort of like Rosemary's baby.
Sure, sure.
And that's where medicine came in.
Sure. Good. In your book, Rudy and Stephen, you talk about different applications of the law of similar. Can you explain a little bit about that?
Rudy.
You want me to do it?
Sure, go ahead.
Oh, okay.
Well, I haven't heard from you for a while. I thought maybe you were being chased by a polar bear.
Where are you?
I was just enjoying your exposition there.
Okay.
Well,
you're on.
I think this is something that we could probably elaborate on in a subsequent session. But in essence, what we're talking about here is that as Stephen has pointed out, you have these two fundamental types of diseases, one which is the realm, you could say, of homeopathy, which is this symptom matching or symptom similarity, which is the realm of these variable vasin or variable nature diseases, which we call pathic diseases because it relates to the symptomology. And you have the these other tonic diseases, which relate to a kind of constant vasin or constant nature. Well, the tonic dimension or realm has all these different jurisdictions that Hahnemann pointed out. And the most fundamental one, of course, that we work with first, and he mentions in the introduction, is these so-called homogenic diseases. And this is a word he uses exactly in the introduction to the Organon. So the homogenic dimension is the dimension of what he calls a disease irritation. So the shocks and traumas, physical and emotional, the arnica for contusion disease, the apis for a bee sting, all of the first aid diseases that you treat not by the symptomology per se, but simply by the remedy that is associated in a constant way. And Hahnemann listed many of these in the chronic diseases. But you have others, the iatrogenic that he points out. Of course, he was quite grim on the ability to deal with them, but he notes that. The pathogenic, the so-called classical infectious diseases, and then I'll pass it over to Stephen. He can talk about the one that he pointed out very clearly to me I never saw before, which is what he calls the ideogenic. Stephen, you want to explain that one?
Well, yes, that's something that was made famous by Rajan Sankaran. That was the state of mind.
Mm-hmm.
And this ability to construe an entire disease phenomenon by getting at this core state of mind was something that you'll find in the Organon between aphorism 210 and 230. It's a whole section upon that very subject.
And the highest disease.
That was what he called, yes, the highest. That contained in that section a reference to the highest disease, which was based upon taking in a belief, which he called an Aberglauben, superstition, under the guise of ignorance. And he gave an example of that in the footnote to Aphorism 17, where he talked about people dying within a short period of time because of some prophecy that they believed in, although they were otherwise normally healthy. And so he gave these examples of people being able to become subject to a very powerful belief or belief system, and that it was having an effect upon their physiology and could usher them right out of life if it was very powerful. So that was a realm called ideogenic disease. And so we had several different dimensions along the tonic path of disease. And of late, we've even gotten deeper with Dr. Rakovic going down into the realm of homotoxicology, which is actually kind of an extension of his homogenic principle of specific irritants. So you have this sort of homotoxic realm, and then you have what Dr. Elminger pointed out as far as his iatrogenic disease results that had to be cleared in a certain sequential backwards motion. And then you got into the nosode applications in the realm of the miasms, which is basically on the ISO principle. And then you moved on up through certain kinds of traumatic diseases of what Hahnemann called the feeling, not a feeling, but based on the feeling, like ignatia for grief, for example. And then you would move up into the highest disease, which was the ideogenic realm that we mentioned. So on the other hand, you had a pathic disease program too, which was based upon a principle, but for some reason no one seemed to read that part of the Organon about that it was based on the thermal principle, a way of differentiating pathic diseases from one another. And he goes into that in some detail in the Organon, starting with Aphorism 239 and 235, and I can't remember what the other one is right now. But it's I think it was 89, the footnote. And if you read all those passages upon this exact notation of the thermal, fever, perspiration, chills, that sort of thing, that he saw in this a principle that was actually underlying the disturbance, so that the symptomology was actually gathered around that thermal principle. That's what he would call an Inbegriff, which is what I you could translate as a quintessential inclusive concept of the disease. It was always translated totality, like the word Gesamtheit, but it wasn't. It was something quite different, and I guess the translators didn't understand what the difference between Inbegriff and Gesamtheit was, but that was one of the things I was very, very careful to point out in the translation, is that he was looking at these pathic diseases, even they were based on a principle, and not just simply upon symptoms, because everybody knows how many times you can group a bunch of symptoms and come up with a remedy that doesn't work. It's not a remedy. And go on 6-7 times before you hit on something that may work, or never hit on something that works. But that principle was left out of account, and in our time is actually utilizable with regulation thermography.
Well, you know, a very rich source of discussion, and I know that we're going to be able to pick up on a lot of these issues and discuss them in more depth on the future calls on June 8th and June 29th. I want to just ask one more quick question, though, rather than getting into these issues in more depth, and it specifically revolves around the work of Kent, because even though in schools today and most people are reading the sixth edition of the Organon, it seems to me at least that most people practice in a more Kentian way, which seems to be largely more akin to, if you were going to make an analogy, to the fourth edition, although even there it doesn't seem to be exactly fourth edition. So I know that in your book, Hahnemann Revisited, you have some specific criticisms of Kent's work, and I thought perhaps you could just give us a quick summary of those.
Well, I think it's fair to say that we not only have criticism, we actually have some praise, but I think one of the things that we did point out is that in some areas Kent really made some fundamental errors, I think, which are important to understand. I'll just give you two, for example, because I know we don't have a lot of time. But in one case, he says that Sora is the cause of all contagion. Well, if you read Hahnemann, this is not at all what Hahnemann said. Another example is he says very clearly that shocks of a physical or emotional nature can't produce disease. Well, this again flies in the face of what Dr. Hahnemann points out very clearly when he, as Stephen said, you know, Ignatia for grief, Arnica for contusion disease. So you kind of ask sometimes what he was specifically reading. I think part of it was some influence of the Swedenborgian idea of this simple essence and a little bit of this kind of emphasis on essence, which has a mystical overtone, and he kind of forgot some of the basic groundings that are there.
Of course, what he's most famous for is constitutional prescribing.
Yes.
And that's an interesting thing, because I took that for granted by the time I got back to Hahnemann, only to find out that I couldn't find a shred of it in Hahnemann. There's nothing about constitutional prescribing. And so that was all something I had to learn about from Kent.
I guess that is the reason somebody once told me that Hahnemann was a bad homeopath.
Do you guys know, does the word constitutional prescribing, does that actually start with Kent, or is there another, do we know that?
I believe it started with Kent. Yeah, he talks about it, yeah.
Yeah.
But what we do know is that it didn't start with Hahnemann.
Oh, no, I know that. I was just curious if it was actually Kent who first coined the term. Or
as far as we've been able to ascertain, I think that's the case.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's very interesting, and I know this is kind of a shocker to end the call on this, because I'm sure a lot of people were thinking that, you know, Kent and Hahnemann were two peas in a pod, and, you know, if you were talking about Kent's understanding of homeopathy, it was pretty much the same as Hahnemann's, and yet clearly when you get into it a little bit deeper, you find that there are some very fundamental differences, and I think those are very clearly elucidated in your works. So,
right, that's why we would propose, that's why we actually wrote the book.
Is that the original reason? Is that correct?
Yeah, to clearly elucidate all of this.
Is that right? Yeah.
You know, it's a little difficult to tell everybody one by one.
Sure, sure. Well, it's absolutely a fascinating work. I know that our company, DHR Books, does sell it, and I know you guys sell it as well. So I'll just I'll put in a little plug. If anybody does want to order the book, they can either acquire it through us at DHR Books. The toll-free number is 866-599-5950. That's 866-599-5950. Or you can order it directly from the Heilkunst Center. Do you want to give a number for that?
Well, the best is to go to the website, www.heilkunst.com.
Yeah, it's electronic. It's all in HTML.
Yeah.
Oh, that's right. Everything is now available in HTML, isn't it?
Yes.
Searchable.
Yeah, fantastic. Okay.
Kim,
well,
I will say we do have hard copies of all the occasional writings and everything in stock as well here.
Thanks, Allison, for letting everybody know that. So, well, this was a very enlightening call. Again, this is just the first in a three-part series. We'll be doing two more of these calls. The next one will be on June 8th, and then that's a Tuesday at the same time, and then again on June 29th, Tuesday as well at the same time. I'm going to unmute everybody so they can personally say thank you to Rudy Vesper and Stephen Decker for taking the time out to share with us. I think it's been a very instructive call, and I think we're going to get into this a little more deeper, and some of these issues will become even clearer on the second and third call. So let me unmute it. And would everybody like to say thank you to...
Thank you, Rudy.
Thank you,
Stephen.
Thanks,
thank
gentlemen.
Thanks,
Rudy.
Thank
you. Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you.
Bye.
Wonderful.
Stephen Decker, are you still there?
Yes, I'm here.
This is Andy Hendrickson down in California. Oh,
yes.
You're probably in California, too.
I'm in Santa Barbara.
remember me? We met at a conference one time up in San Rafael and had an overnight talk.
Oh, yes. Yes, Andy. Great.
How are
you again? Wonderful.
That was just a great talk, and you know, I've kind of been following your progress over time. I didn't get Hahnemann re-examined, but now I realize my wisdom in that, because now I get the newest gig.
Yeah, the fully expanded version.
The final, or well, maybe not final, but certainly the best version.
Well, that's the nice thing about having a book online. It's always a work in progress.
That's true, isn't it?
Yes.
I was going to joke. I thought they were going to allow questions to be asked.
We'll allow for questions on the second two calls.
Oh, yeah. Well, no, Ken, that was a masterful, masterful interview. You are really a phenomenal interviewer. You know, this is...
Well, I have good people to interview, so don't give me any...
Well, that's true. That is absolutely true as well. Yeah, no problem.
Okay, well, I'm going to sign off. You take care, everybody. Stephen and Rudy, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you,
Kim,
and I'll look forward to the next one.
Yes, Addy. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Hey, Stephen.
Yes.
Tesla invented radio.
Yes?
Yeah, actually, I mean, I was going to say it kind of jokingly, but... it actually is true. He invented radio, and he actually won a suit to that effect near the end of his life. And Marconi allegedly stole a lot of Tesla's work. Tesla did it and then said, well, this is kind of a trivial thing, you know.
Yeah, that's so often is the case.
and Marconi took some of the concepts, apparently. I forget exactly the manner in which he did that, but I think he may have actually even studied or worked for Tesla at one point.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't know that. Well, so, Andy, you should contact me directly, personally, sometime, and we could continue our conversation.
That could be an expensive call.
Yeah, well, not too expensive. What do you have a number?
I have a right now. I'm kind of impenetrable. I have a message number only.
Oh, okay.
For you know to keep clients away, but that number is 707-793-2131.
2131, okay.
And I have a voicemail. I mean, that's a voicemail. I have a email, andyh@mcn.org.
@mcn.org.
Yeah.
Okay, well, that's probably the best way to do it right there.
Yeah, how about you?
Yes, you can reach me at goethean@cox.net, cox.net.
Do you mind if I ask you a quick question?
Sure.
Hahnemann was supposedly a member of either a Masonic group or some other society. I read a reference to that at some point. And I believe when I read about that, it was alluded that he, from there, had had gotten great insights on many things. I mean, your work elucidates a lot of the sources for some of his theoretical backing for some of his possible insights and inspirations. Goethe and Coleridge, one of my favorite poems, the Rhyme of the Ancient Mariner.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing I read seemed to allude that, or imply, or maybe even said, I forget where I read it, that his esoteric, his membership in an esoteric group was an inspiration for the for potentization.
Mm-hmm.
So, did you run into any of that anywhere?
No, I actually never really got too much into his other leanings, other than what he left behind in his writings. I've heard lots of different stories about how he got into potentization, and so who knows for sure. But thank God he did.
Right, yeah. Okay, that remains kind of an unexplained thing. There's a mythos about it, about, you know, riding on his horse or wagon or something, and I think that's some of that might be partly true, you know, shaking the medicines on the way to visit. But
yes, exactly. I have to see clients or something, right?
But according to research done by Julian Winston, not necessarily exhaustive, that he didn't go to see clients much. Clients came to him for the most part.
Well, that's what I understood, right. But I had heard that story about him jostling his medicines as he rode around.
Yeah.
But it's really great to hear from you again, and we'll send an email message, make contact that way.
Okay, cool.
Good. So where are you?
Can you look at Article 273 about a single remedy?
Yes, that's all treated of in great detail in the book.
So the book is Hahnemann Revisited?
No, it's called The Dynamic Legacy, and it's on homeopathy.com.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
I'm up in Mendocino County.
Mendocino, okay.
Yeah.
Good. Okay, well, I'll have to sign off now, and
yeah,
I'll be looking for you an email then.
Yeah, fine.
Okay,
Andy. Thanks very much, and congratulations on your career.
Okay, thank you very
pretty
much.
Pretty nice contribution.
Yeah.
And look forward to the next talk, which is actually happening on my birthday.
Oh, great. Okay. Try and remember that. I'll wear a bow. Okay. Good night. Nice talking to you, Andy. I'll be seeing you soon on email.
Blessings to you, man.
Okay. You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Could you give that website name again?
The website is www.heilkunst, HEILKUNST.com.
And that will tell me about the books?
The book is The Dynamic Legacy.
And there's information on that website. Is this Ahmed?
Yes.
Hi, Ahmed. We need to thank you for your incredible contributions.
Thank you. I'd like to call you. Shall I call you? Is that Allison?
No, this is Patty. This is Rudy's wife.
Oh, well.
I had dinner with you at an Indian restaurant in Boston about 12 years ago.
Really? I'm sorry. What is your name again?
Patty Smith.
Oh, sure. I remember you.
And you had him bring us out the good chutney.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. I'd love to do it again. I want to get these books, Dynamic Legacy and this Hahnemann Revisited, or is it Homeopathy Revisited?
It's called The Dynamic Legacy.
That includes everything.
And that includes Homeopathy Revisited.
Where can I buy it?
Greg, talk to Greg Cooper.
Okay, Greg Cooper.
Or you can get in touch with us through the website.
Okay. Thank you. www.heilkunst.com.
And all the information's there. And Rudy's always here. If you have any questions, he'd be happy to talk with you.
I would feel very honored to talk with him.
Well, we'd be honored to have you talk with him.
What phone number is that?
613-692-692-6950.
692-9590.
Can try. The last ones are... Oh, there's noise. 692-6950.
626-920 at area code 613.
Yes.
Thank you so much, Patty.
Well, thank you for your work, Ahmed.
Yes, you've done wonderful work with Kent's material.
You mean the book that I wrote?
And Grimmer.
Yes, on
Guide
Grimmer.
Guide to Kent Repertory?
Kent's Repertory, but Grimmer as well.
Well, I'm very honored that you found it useful.
Yes, we did.
For your wonderful conference.
I keep the Grimmer book by my bed.
Well, there are several cancer patients who have written to me and thanked me because they got well.
Well, there's wonderful information in that one.
Well, that's thanks to Grimmer's daughter.
Yes, I know.
You know, she died.
I remember we had a conference one time and she was there.
I know, but you know, she just died recently.
She did.
Yeah.
I think it was a national...
January 25th.
This year?
Yes, January 26th, actually, in the early morning. I'm going to write it up. She went into respiratory failure and she died peacefully.
Wow.
And she
good.
Was kept alive by her father's remedy, Ali Arsenicosum.
Oh, that's a great one.
Yeah, which I prescribed for her, and she used it for about 2 years.
Well, I remember when she came to one of the conferences at the National Center for Homeopathy, and you introduced her.
Oh, yeah, that was a great privilege. Thanks to her, we got Grimmer.
Yes, I know.
He released all his handwritten manuscripts to me, and I spent about 20 years putting them together.
A lot of work, a lot of love.
A lot of love is right, but without her love and without her encouragement, it would not have happened. So we remember her often now, and her family has been very helpful, and especially during this time since she died that we have been working together.
Wow.
Thank you for your input, and thank you for sustaining us.
Thank you. Rudy?
Yes, thank you. It takes a lot of people to move it all forward, so we all have a contribution to make.
Well, I feel very privileged that I was given and allowed this opportunity by the universe to do that.
Yes, and we appreciate it.
Okay, Rudy, I look forward to meeting you sometime.
Yes, I do too.
Where are you?
I'm fine.
Where are you? In?
Ottawa.
Ottawa, Canada.
Oh, okay, good.
Not too far.
My wife is from Montreal, and we look forward to coming there again.
Oh, well, if you get to Montreal, let us know.
Okay, my wife just picked up the Dynamic Legacy on Google, and so I'm going to order it.
Okay.
Thank you, Rudy.
Well, thank you.
Be well.
Take care.
You too.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Hey, Rudy. Hello?
Patty? Rudy?
Yeah, this is me, Ben.
Oh, have Patty and Rudy already signed off?
Oh, did they?
I'm not sure.
Who is this?
This is Cindy Griffin down in Houston.
Oh, I see. My name is Ben. I'm a student of theirs in my third year, and I had just wanted to say hello, but I guess they probably hung up there after Ahmed was speaking with them.
Apparently so. I was going to tell them hi because I'm going to be up at NUPAC speaking this fall, so I was just going to tell them hi and thanks. So anyway, if you're going to be at NUPAC, maybe I'll meet you there.
Maybe. What are you going to be speaking about?
Autism. Working with autistic kids.
Uh-huh.
So we've had getting more and more experience, unfortunately. But, you know, the good thing is I think I can share some of what we're seeing. So they've asked me to speak up there.
Uh-huh.
So hopefully if you're going to be around, introduce yourself.
Is that going to be in Toronto again?
That'll be in Toronto, yes. October, like 14th and 15th, or 15th and 16th. It's that weekend, whatever dates those are.
Oh yeah, well, Cindy, huh? Well, I'll see if I can be there. I'd like to be. I went to one 3 years ago, and it was really enlightening.
Last year's was great, and I got to kind of renew my acquaintance. I studied with Sherry Eric down here in Houston when Rudy was still over BIH,
uh-huh.
And I've been practicing for about 7 years now, so.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, well, if you run into him before I do, tell him I said hi.
Okay, I will, Cindy.
Have a good evening.
Can
too.
I get a flyer as to your schedule there?
New Path has got it on their website, I think. But if they don't, contact Ati Petrov. Ati has got all of that, I think, lined out. Or Patty has got it, if you email her.
No computer.
Okay.
Give me a number.
Yeah, if you can call Patty, if
what's her number?
I don't think I've got her number handy.
You can call the registrar at the Hahnemann College for Homeopathy and Heilkunst. My name is Allison McQuinn, and I'm the former registrar.
And the number?
The phone number is area code 613-830-2556.
2556.
Yes.
Great.
And when you speak with Venetia.
With whom?
When you speak with Venetia.
All right.
She is the present registrar of the Hahnemann College for Homeopathy and Heilkunst. She will give you the number for New Path. And if you have access to the internet, it's www.newpath.org.
Okay. Thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
No problem.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Well, this was very, very interesting. Wow, I learned that people don't understand the man who translated. His name is Decker.
Decker.
Now, he is, apparently, speaks German.
German name.
Yeah, I gotta pee real bad. Wait. Whew, that's a name I just heard. Now, Doc, when I told Doc... Did I turn this off?